Weather can hide the truth, but it can also reveal the truth.
The suspects can never compensate for the weather, and that's good for us.
More than 150 violent crimes are committed every hour in this country, according to the FBI. But an increasing number of these crimes are being solved with the help of a new breed of weather professionals called forensic meteorologists.
Forensic meteorology is to use meteorology to find the truth in a court case where weather was a factor.
And anything from lightning to hail to snow, even the temperature can be a critical factor when it comes to revealing the truth in a court of law.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me remotely today is...
And as we're all remotely, but I'm in London, which is still grey and drizzly, is Laura Richards, former criminal behavioural analyst, New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And at the other end of Los Angeles County, I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague.
And we have a very special guest today.
I'm Elizabeth Austin, and I am a forensic meteorologist coming to you from Lake Tahoe, Nevada.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We have so much to talk about with respect to forensic meteorology and the new Weather Channel show, Storm of Suspicion.
The Weather Channel show, Storm of Suspicion. So you will want to check your local listings for wherever you are and what time it will be airing. After Sunday, October 7th, the first show, then the series can be watched every Sunday night through November.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining us, Dr. Austin.
Thank you for having me.
So can you take a footprint out of snow? I know it's kind of random, but if somebody leaves their footprints in snow, can you get a good cast out of it? Or?
Well, that's interesting because that's one episode deals with that very issue.
Oh, okay. In the Storm of Suspicion.
There you go. Yes. There's okay. Reading minds again.
Sorry.
Lisa.
Oh, my God.
And it's quite interesting the way it's done. It's a case up in Canada, and I won't give it away, yeah. But it's a great episode because it deals with that exact issue.
Wow. Yeah, it must be difficult to do, yeah. It's hard enough in mud. Yeah, it's hard enough. And what's worse is sand, okay? But it happens, and if you have a skilled forensic evidence collector, then they can work wonders. And people like Bobby Chacon collected evidence underwater and documented it in place and used sideways and downward looking radar to find things. And it's really amazing what they can do, even under really harsh circumstances.
It is. And let's say even if you have a vehicle and if it's like a hurricane comes through or a big flood or something, it may erase evidence on the outside of the vehicle, but it doesn't erase usually evidence on the inside as long as the water doesn't get in and just inundate the car vehicle sits in the water for too long.
Yeah,
right. And the first show, which is on October the 7th, that is that Hurricane Harvey. Is that going to be your first one? A case that relates to that?
That it is. That's the first case, and Hurricane Harvey when it hit Texas. And in fact, I remember seeing the murder that we focus on for this. I remember seeing it on the news. And telling my husband, I wonder if someone tried to stage this because they knew the hurricane was coming in. That was my first comment.
Oh, wow. You
to him.
Thought that like from the start.
I did. Yeah.
Well, can you say anything about what the clues were of what piqued your interest as to whether that was the case or not?
It was what piqued my interest is because, first of all, she went missing. They couldn't find her. Then they found her car. And then they ended up finding her body. And there are a lot of potential killers that they looked at. But I, right off the bat, just thought, this is a bit very suspicious that this happens right when Hurricane Harvey is hitting Texas. So, but I don't want to give anything away.
No spoilers, but I'm looking forward to watching it. It sounds great. So every case is quite different that we're going to see when it airs.
Oh, it's every case is very, very different. That's what's so great. Summer snow, rain, mud, winds, everything. It's great. Some have to do with footprints, palm prints, blood. It's just kind of runs the gamut, which is really great.
This seems like a real teachable moment, though, for certainly the public to be, you know, aware of when a big weather event is coming, to be on guard, but also for law enforcement. I mean, do you do trainings for law enforcement at all in this way?
No, I don't. But, you know, it's something for them to always keep in mind, the fact that, and I know they have curfews and everything, and you just quote unquote hope that people are responsible and good, but there are always those people who aren't.
Right. So when there's a curfew, law enforcement is out there because if somebody's out and about, they're up to no good, or they're, you know.
Or they're at risk.
Yeah.
Or a law enforcement also can't even be there. And let's say it's, you know, all the flooding that's going on, for example, they may have curfews for people who stayed back behind. And then maybe some people try and sneak in. I don't know. But if it's a dangerous situation in terms of the weather or flooding, then no one can be there.
And when you go to court to testify, how hard is it to get a jury to kind of understand what you're talking about? Do you have to change the way that you explain the science at all? I mean, not to mean that people can't understand it, but are they convinced of your findings, or?
You know, that's an interesting question because, for example, some of the cases where, you know, I run these sophisticated models, and even if not, a lot of the data can be, we make calculations from data, and we'll use various sources of data and types of data. Sometimes I'll have to write a report, and then some states don't require reports. But then when I show up, I have to break it down into very digestible chunks, and I try and make very good graphics and animations. We have a whole team here to help with that, because if I can help get my point across through a very good few graphics or an animation, juries, they really like that. First of all, they're used to seeing weather on the news. Mm-hmm. They want to see the radar, they want to see the satellite, and then they want to have a timeline and have it make sense weather-wise. So that's my job once I'm on the stand, is to break it down so that they can understand it. Now, not everyone on the jury has to understand it, but I have to get my point across definitely to a few on the jury. And then they can go back and explain it, if need be, to the others.
Mm. Hmm. Wow. And so when you're testifying, how are you coming in under Daubert? How do you establish your expertise?
That is established through the attorney or attorneys that has hired me. And then, you know, the judge makes the determination. But I've done it so much now, I've never not been allowed to testify or not qualified. So, but I have to say, for each scientist or expert witness, you know, expert witnesses aren't lay witnesses. They're held to a different standard, a much higher standard, because this is our expertise. We don't guess. And so everything we have to say is to a high degree of scientific certainty. And so we don't stray out of our specific area. And even in the atmospheric sciences, we don't stray out of our area of expertise in our own field.
Yeah, and just for our listeners who don't know, so Daubert is a case that allows a attorney to bring evidence, expert testimony, to explain things that aren't within the experience of the average juror. So when you have things like complicated weather models that most jurors don't really know about, then they could bring in an expert and explain the details so that when the evidence comes in, they know to give it more weight because it's actually based on scientific principles.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes the trials, you know, will be a jury trial, but other times it'll be what's called a bench trial, which means the judge, just in front of the judge, there is no jury. And they're both quite different. Not all judges are weather savvy. So it's a similar thing with the judge, although usually there's a little less explanation that needs to go in with some of the evidence.
Yeah. I have a question that's slightly unrelated, just seeing how many publications you have and all your achievements, which I have to say are incredibly impressive. But I wondered what your greatest achievement is so far.
Oh boy, I've never been asked that.
Good, Laura.
I like to come up with things never asked before. You won an award at the beginning of the year. It seems like, you know, you had an award from the American Meteorological Society, and you know, you've just, you're so prestigious in terms of what you do and being a woman. I mean, it's, you know, fantastic.
Yes, probably being recognized by my peers at the American Meteorological Society, and I won the Fellow Award, which was very, just such an honor. But I really like when young kids get excited about weather and science, and they don't have to say, oh, I want to be a meteorologist. I just like it that they want to learn about it, know about it, learn about the atmosphere, the planet, and enjoy it. I like that quite a bit.
Yeah, well, you're a fantastic role model. I think the more we can connect this with young girls and boys so that they know that there is a career there and there's lots of different specialisms you can go into, because, you know, like Lisa said, she hadn't heard about it before, about what you do specifically. It's great to educate our listeners that, you know, some will be very interested in finding out more and what they can do to become a Dr. Austin making.
And especially how active you are. Like, you know, when I do my job, I can basically do it in my office in front of a computer with my coffee cup. And if I get up to go to the, you know, the printer, that's about all I have to do. But you are everywhere, not only in the ice, you're in the desert, you're everywhere. It's such an act.
You're in New Zealand. I saw some footage of you in New Zealand.
I love that.
I know. That's what's so great also about this job is weather is everywhere. So one can get in this field and pretty much live anywhere around the globe and be a professor, a researcher, a forecaster, you know, do all kinds of interesting things.
What were you doing in New Zealand?
That was part of the Purland project. We were flying, trying to get our world record flights done down there. We had to be close to the poles.
The polar vortex.
Yes, that's right.
See, I know something. There we go.
That's exactly right. And so, but we ended up switching over after a few years to El Calafate, Argentina, which is a little over 50 degrees south latitude. So we're on the edge of the polar night jet, which it's part of the polar vortex. So we have to be down there when the polar vortex is active. So actually the glider is just being shipped back to the United States now after our season down there.
So the polar vortex, is that a upwardly moving stream of air?
No, it is actually a circulating jet stream in the stratosphere, just like the one that we have that we're familiar with, like in our mid-latitudes. That's, you know, when you're flying in an airplane like 30, 35,000 feet, that jet stream that steers our weather systems, it's very similar to that, except it's up in the stratosphere and it only occurs around the poles in it during the respective winter times. Well, it starts in, you know, just prior to winter, and then it ends up once winter is over, it disappears. So it, because you need the cold Arctic or Antarctic nights and the circulation of the globe. And so you get the sharp temperature contrast. And then interestingly enough, the polar vortex on the outer edge is this polar night jet. And that's this band of high-speed winds that is up in the stratosphere. That isolates the atmosphere there. And that's where we get the ozone hole that everyone's heard of that ends up in that center of the polar vortex.
Wow. And so once you get the plane in that high speed set of winds, you can sort of ramp it up and keep going up and up and up.
What we use is a combination of a bunch of things, but we like prefrontal conditions where a storm is coming in and we're on the lee side of a mountain range. So we get what's called mountain waves. So these waves, just like if you threw a rock in a pond and you see those waves, those waves are generated because of the mountains and the air flowing over them, but they also go upward, and the jet stream down below and the polar night jet up above lend energy to these. So these waves continue well up into the stratosphere and the glider rides these waves.
Wow.
Fascinating.
The storm is going to be much worse than anyone expected.
In this case, the sheriff's department got a call about a missing persons case right as Hurricane Harvey was about to hit land. So as we're recreating the scenes, we're actually recreating the rainstorms and the wind.
Weather created the opportunity for the perfect crime. However, in the end, weather also helped solve this case.
I also wanted to talk to you about tides and tide schedules, because that's affected by the moon and the weather, right?
Oh, it is. And tides are also a big player, for example, during wartime, bringing ships in or not, and then also visibility along with that. But it plays a big role in a lot of our past wars.
Yeah, because I worked on a wrongful conviction case that had to do with an attack that was alleged on the beach. But when two things were found out, one is that it rained that night, and two is that at the time that the event was alleged, the tides were at their highest, and the beach that normally exists maybe about, 50 or 60 feet deep was only about 10 feet to 0 feet deep at this time because it was high tide. And so those two things kind of ruled out the possibility that this could have happened on the beach where it was alleged to have happened.
Interesting. Yes.
I basically went down there to the beach at this when the tide was at the same level that it was reported that night, and documented, with video what the waves looked like and how little of the beach was left. And also there was the way this victim said they went across this beach, actually, because of the tide being so high, that way was blocked because there was only a wall of rocks, of slippery, sharp rocks would have had to have been climbed over rather than walking across the beach, as was stated.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And, we've talked about cold weather, but we haven't really talked about the heat. And the New York Times just had an article out the other day about the rise in murder when it's very, very hot outside. I think that which just feels anecdotally true, that tempers are high and people have easy triggers when you're just hot and you can't think. But is there some scientific data about that, or have you seen that in your work?
Oh, yes. There have been a lot of studies done on this, especially in various cities all around the globe. When it gets hot outside, the temperature goes up, crime definitely goes up for a number of reasons. A lot of it is more people are out and about. Also, tensions go up, and not just, let's say, for example, murders, but a lot of rapes and that kind of activity also really goes up when the temperature goes up.
Yeah, when I was studying for a master's course in criminology, I read a study that said that ice cream consumption raises the murder rate. And they looked at Chicago during a particular summer, and the murder rate had spiked significantly, and so had the ice cream rate. So they said that there was a correlation between the two. I mean, that's just how ridiculous some of these studies can be. But the fact is that was a year when there was a heat wave where there was a major blackout. People's air conditioners didn't work. People were forced out into the street. So certainly ice cream consumption probably went up. That was great because it cooled some people off. But it had nothing to do with the fact that they were all out on the street and their tempers were higher because it was so aggravating that the electricity was out for a long period of time and people are on top of each other rather than being chilling out in their own homes. And so there are 100 other factors that actually weighed in. But that's when I got involved in looking at chaos theory in terms of predicting weather and in terms of predicting criminology, because I think those two things can both be accurately predicted by chaos theory, which basically says the number of points of measure that you have, the more points of measure, the more accurately you can predict something happening. And so if you look at all those factors that you were talking about, Dr. Austin, the heat index, the aggravation level of people, the people that are out on the street, the rapes that are happening, the nuisance crimes that are happening, the looting that's happening, all that kind of stuff that goes on during times when the electricity is out for prolonged periods, people don't have resources and they take them, you know, and that starts a chain of events and, you know, arsons and how that all sort of builds up. If you look at all those factors, you can predict more accurately what might happen in terms of homicide. And
that's true.
And and basing it just on ice cream consumption, I don't think that is actually a good way to do it.
I'm relieved to hear that. I eat a lot of ice cream, yeah. And a lot of my friends do too. That you alarmed me for a moment, Jim. I thought you were going to validate that study in some way.
No, I was pretty upset when I read that, and when I came in, you know, I did a report and I used chaos theory to explain how we could predict better when, you know, trends in crime, and I think they're doing that much more now with big data. Yeah. And that's, big data is basically using chaos theory, but as a predictive model. And I know that when I read my paper, you know, when I presented it, my professor, I just remember this vividly. She put her hands on the side of her head and put her face down on the desk and said, "My brain is going to explode."
That's what I do on a daily basis with you guys. You're describing me.
That's good feedback. I mean, we used to have the debate all the time in the Met, and it came up, you know, pretty regularly about the lunar cycle and whether that had an effect on people committing rape and murder. And then, you know, people would publish various things on it. I don't know if you have a view on that, Dr. Austin.
Well, I have read some studies that when there's a full moon, that emergency rooms get a lot busier with people coming in because of all kinds of incidents and accidents and things. So, but I did have read
that. We have done an episode on that, by the way. And whether it's true or not, if people believe it's true that some wild thing comes out of people when it's a full moon, it's
sort of folklore, at least in most police departments. But I mean, the moon, you know, has an effect. I mean, it certainly has an effect on tides, for example. And we already talked about how tides can affect crime. But, you know, we are, as human beings, we're little energy systems. I mean, vibrations and electrons zooming about and all sorts of
electrical. There's a song about that too, Jim. Good vibrations, isn't there?
There you go.
We seem to be doing this in songs. I'm not sure why.
But I mean, if we are beings, I mean, we're matter and energy, and we produce energy, and I'm sure energy affects us. So I don't think it's a huge leap to say that when the energy of the lunar cycle affects the Earth in a particular way, it also affects the beings on that Earth in a particular way.
That's right. And then in addition, the lighting conditions are quite different when you have a big full moon as opposed to no moon at all.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and you know, there are many times when people say they saw something and, well, actually it would be impossible under those lighting conditions. I mean, one of the things that affects people's vision, the lack of sunlight, can turn everything into sort of sepia tones and black and white, and people lose the ability to tell color at night. And that can actually be very, very disconcerting for somebody who's driving a gray car and somebody saw a car and it looked gray because it was late at night, but the actual car was blue, bright blue. And, you know, so it can change things in people's minds. And we've talked a lot about, or Lisa and I have talked a lot about the fact that eyewitness testimony is the least reliable type of testimony that comes into evidence at a trial, because people's observations can be very biased and their memories can be imperfect.
That's exactly right. I have to deal a lot with that at times when there are eyewitnesses. And interestingly enough, sometimes it does come down to the color of a car or a shirt or something. But at other times, it's things like, well, the winds were like hurricane force winds. And, you know, another person says it was barely windy at all. So trying to deal with eyewitness accounts can, you know, be be a little.
Well, because it's subjective, yeah. Right? If you're from Canada, a storm may not seem that significant, but you know, if you're not, it might seem huge.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
I also saw a funny little clip about Hurricane Florence, and there was a news caster who was stood, you know, in the eye of the storm, as it were, and he was really kind of trying to stand and fight against the wind, or so it looked as he was presenting. Did you see it? And two guys just walked behind him completely normally with no resistance to the wind at all and just show him out for kind of, you know, really hamming it up.
That's hysterical.
I know, I did see that. Yes.
Well, another one where a woman was newscasting, and I don't know if somebody played with the recording or not, the video or not, but I mean, she's standing there newscasting, and a stop sign comes and just knocks her over. I don't know if that was real or not, but that looked pretty bad.
Oh God,
that's gotta hurt.
So I wanted to ask the doc, what does she do to relax? I mean, do you watch TV? Do you play music? Do you what do you do to sort of on your
go day? Surfing? Yeah. Goes climbing mountains. Goes in a glider plane. Goes skiing.
Let's talk about Dr. Snow. Yeah,
Dr. Snow.
I understand that your pen name is Dr. Snow.
That's
true. Tell us about that.
That came about when I was doing a kind of a monthly article for Powder Magazine long ago. For those who don't know, that's a big skier magazine and still going. And so that's where that name came from, and it just kind of stuck.
So you love skiing, I imagine.
I do. I love skiing. I love sports. I love music. I like drawing. I like reading books. What? And I am sometimes a crime murder junkie on TV, you know, with the different shows that are on, not the real shows.
Oh, like darn. Shows. I thought you were going to say Criminal Minds, but that's okay.
Well, hopefully you saw Laura and I in The Case of JonBenet Ramsey and The Case of Kaylee Anthony. Those are real crime shows.
That's right. That's true.
And even Manhunt Unabomber is based on reality. The hunt for the Unabomber, and our friend Jim Fitzgerald, who was a forensic linguist, who, like you, turned an interest in a particular field into a forensic field. So he's a forensic linguistic profiler, and you're a forensic meteorologist. Mm, that's so cool.
It is.
Yes. It's interesting that he did that.
Yeah, well, you should watch Manhunt Unabomber on Netflix.
I will.
All right, cool.
And you and Laura have to go skiing. That's what I want to see that on our Instagram.
That would be great.
I would love to. Be fantastic.
I'll be in the lodge drinking some cocoa while you guys go out.
Well, it's great talking to you, Dr. Austin. And we've learned so much about forensic meteorology. And it's so cool that you can help out prosecutors and plaintiff's attorneys and defense attorneys for cases where the weather is involved in litigation or criminal activity.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.